The Inigo Museum, in reality a shrine, was every bit as bad as Aaron had expected it to be. For a start, they couldn't just wander around. They had to join the line of the devout outside the main entrance, and were assigned a guide. The tour was official and structured. Each item was accompanied by a full-sense recording and corresponding emotional content radiating out into the Gaia field. He gritted his teeth and put on a passive smile as they were led around Inigo's childhood home, which had been uprooted diligently from its original location 2 kilometers away and lovingly restored using era-authentic methods and materials. Each room contained a boring yet worshipful account of his childhood days. There were solidos of his mother, Sabine, cute dramas of his grandparents, whose house it was, a sad section devoted to his father, Eric Horovy, who left Sabine a few short months after the birth, and a reconstruction of the local hospital's maternity ward. Aaron gave the solido of Eric a thoughtful stare, and sent his U-shadow into its public data store to extract useful information. Eric had been 18 years old when Inigo was born. Aaron checked. Sabine had been a month short of her 18th birthday when she gave birth. "Didn't they have a contraception program here in those days?" he asked the guide abruptly. Corilyn groaned and flushed a mild pink. The guide's pleasant smile flickered slightly, returning in a somewhat harder manifestation. "Excuse me?" "Contraception. It's pretty standard for teenagers, no matter what cultural stream you grow up in." He paused, reviewing the essentially non-existent information on Sabine's parents. "Unless the family was old-style Catholics, or initiated Taliban, or evangelical Orthodox." "Were they?" "They were not," the guide said stiffly. "Inigo was proud that he did not derive from any of Earth's appalling medieval religious sects. It means his goals remained untainted." "I see. So his birth was planned, then?" "His birth was a blessing to humanity. He is the one chosen by the Water Walker to show us what lies within the void. Why do you ask?" "Are you some kind of Unisphere journalist?"
"Certainly not. I'm a cultural anthropologist. Naturally, I'm interested in procreation rituals."
The guide gave him a suspicious stare, but let it pass. Aaron's U-shadow had been ready to block any query the man shot into the local net. They had managed to get through the museum's entrance without any alarm, which meant Living Dream had not issued a Commonwealth-wide alert yet. But they'd certainly respond swiftly enough to any identity file matching himself and Corilyn, no matter what planet it originated from. And the fact that it came from Anagaska, barely 2 days after the Riasi incident, would reveal exactly what type of starship they were using. He could not allow that.
"Hardly a ritual," the guide sniffed. "Anthropologists think everything we do is summed up in terms of rituals," Corilyn said smoothly. "Now tell me, is this really Inigo's university dorm?"
She waved her hand eagerly at the drab holographic room in front of them. Various shabby and decayed pieces of furniture that resembled those shown in full 3D color were on display in transparent stasis chambers.
"Yes," the guide said, returning to equilibrium. "Yes, it is. This is where he began his training as an astrophysicist, the first step on the path that took him to Centurion Station. As an environment, its significance cannot be overstated."
"Gosh,"
Corilyn cooed. Aaron was impressed that she kept a straight face.
"What was that all about?"
Corilyn asked when they were in a taxi capsule and heading back for the spaceport hotel.
"You didn't think it was odd? So 2 horny teenagers decided to have a kid. It's not unheard of."
"Yes, it is. They were both still at school. Then Eric vanishes a few months after the birth. Plus, you tell me Inigo had an aunt who has been very effectively written out of his family, and you claim Inigo is higher, which must have happened either at birth or early in his life, that is, prior to his Centurion mission."
"What makes you say that?"
"Because, as you said, he took extreme care to hide it from his followers. It's not logical to assume he'd acquire bionics after he began Living Dream."
"Granted. But where does all this theorizing get you?"
"It tells me just what a load of bullshit his official past is," Aaron said, waving a hand back at the museum. "That farce is a perfect way of covering up his true history.
It provides a flawless alternative version with just enough true points touching verifiable reality as to go unquestioned. Unless, of course, you're like us and happen to know some awkward facts which don't fit. If he was born higher, then one of his parents had to be higher. Sabine almost certainly wasn't, and Eric conveniently walks out on his child a few months after the birth. It was too much for the boy, that's all. If Inigo's birth was an accident like you think, that's hardly surprising. No, that's not it. I don't think it was an accident. Quite the opposite. He told his U-Shadow to review local events for the year prior to Inigo's birth, using non-living dream archives. They'd almost reached the hotel when the answer came back. Ah, ha! This is it. He shared the file with her. Local News Company Archive. They were bought out by an Intersolar 200 years ago, and the town office downgraded to closure, which is why the files were deep cached. The art block in Kumo's college burnt down 8.5 months before Inigo was born. It says the block was the center of a gang fight, Corilyn said as she speed-reviewed. A bunch of hothead kids, duking out a turf war. Yeah, right. Now launch a search for Kumo gang culture, specifically for incidents with weapons use. Go ahead. I'll give you 1,000-to-1 odds. There aren't any other files, not for 50 years either side of that date. Look at the history of this place before Inigo built his monstrosity. There was nothing here worth fighting over, not even for kids on the bottom of the pile. The council switched between 3 parties, and they were all virtually indistinguishable. Their policies were certainly the same: low taxes, cut back on official wastage, attract business investment, and make sure the parks look pretty. Hell, they didn't even manage to get rid of the arcology by themselves. That thing stood there for nearly 900 years. 900 for Aussie's sake! And they couldn't get their act together for all that time. Kumo is the ultimate middle-class dead end, drifting along in the same rut for 1,000 years. Bad boys don't want a part of that purgatory. It's like a suspension sentence, but with sensory torture thrown in. They just want to leave. All right, I submit. Inigo had a dodgy family history. What's your point? My theory is a radical infiltration. It's about the right time period, and that certainly won't be on any news file, deep cached or otherwise. So how do we find out what really happened? Only one way. We have to ask the Protectorate. Corilyn groaned in dismay, dropping her head into her hands. The maintenance hangar was on the edge of Doroka's spaceport, one of 23 identical black sheen cubes in a row, the last row in a block of 10. There were 18 blocks in total. It was a big spaceport, much larger than the Navy compound on the other side of the city. Doroka's residents were a heavily star-faring folk, and the air project had added considerably to the numbers of spaceships in recent centuries. Without any connection to the Unisphere's guidance function, a person could wander around the area all day and not be able to distinguish among any of the hangars. A subtle modification to the spaceport net management software provided a nearly identical disorientation function to any uninvited person who was using electronic navigation to find Troblum's hangar. While the other structures were always opening their doors to receive or disgorge starships, Troblum's was kept resolutely shut, except for his very rare flights. When the doors did iris back, a security shield prevented any visual or electronic observation of the interior. Even the small workforce that loyally turned up day after day parked their capsules outside and used a little side door to enter. They then had to pass through another 3 shielded doors to enter the hangar's central section. Nearly 2/3 of the big building was taken up by extremely sophisticated synthesis and fabrication machinery. All the systems were custom-built. The current layout had taken Troblum over 15 years to refine. That was why he needed other people to help him. Newman Cybernetics and Bionic Extrusion were magnificent systems for everyday life, but for anything beyond the ordinary, one first had to design the machinery to build the machines that fabricated the devices.
Troblum had no trouble producing the modified exotic matter theory behind an anamine planet-shifting FTL engine, and even describing the basic generator technology he wanted. But turning those abstractions into physical reality was tough. For a start, he needed information on Novabomb technology, and even after nearly 1,200 years, the Navy kept details of that horrendously powerful weapon classified. That was where Emily Arm came in. It was Marius who had put the two of them in touch. Emily once had worked for the Navy Weapons Division on Augusta. After 300 years, she had simply grown bored. "There's no point to it anymore," she had told Troblum at their first meeting. "We haven't made any truly new weapons for centuries. All the lab does is refine the systems we have. Any remotely new concept we come up with is closed down almost immediately by the top brass." "You mean ANA governance?" he had asked. "Who knows where the orders originate from? All I know is that they come down from Admiral Casimir's office, and we jump fast and high every time. It's crazy. I don't know why we bother having a weapons research division. As far as I know, the deterrence fleet hasn't changed ships or armaments for 500 years. The problem he had outlined to her was interesting enough for her to postpone downloading into ANA. After Emily, others had joined his motley team. Dan Marcel, whose expertise in functioning molecular configuration was unrivaled. Amy Cowie, who helped them with exotic matter formatting. Several technicians had come and gone over the years, contributing to the Newman cybernetics array, and then leaving as their appliance constructed its required successor. But those three had stuck with him since the early years. Their age and higher-derived patience meant they were probably the only ones who could tolerate him for so long, that and their shared interest in the nature of the project. When Troblum's aging capsule landed on the pad outside the hangar, he was puzzled to see just Emily's and Marcel's capsules sitting on the concrete beside the glossy black wall. He had been expecting Amy as well. Then, as soon as he was through the second little office, he knew something was wrong. There was no quiet vibration of machinery. As soon as the shield over the third door cut off, his low-level field could detect no electronic activity beyond it. The hangar had been divided in half, with Melanie's Redemption parked at one end, a dark, bulky presence very much in the shade of the assembly section. Troblum stood under the prow of the ship and looked around uncomprehendingly. The Newman cybernetic modules in front of him were bigger than a house, joined into a lattice cube of what looked like translucent glass slabs, the size of commercial capsules, each one glowing with its individual primary light. It was as if a rainbow had shattered, only to be scooped up and shoved into a transparent box. At the center, 3 meters above Troblum's head, was a scarlet and black cone, the ejector mechanism of the terminal extruder. It should have been wrapped in a fiercely complex web of quantum fields, intersecting feeder pressors, electron positioners, and molecular lock injectors. He could not detect a glimmer of power. If all had gone well over the last few days, the planet shift engine would have been 2/3 complete, assembled atom by atom in a stable matrix of superdense matter, held together by its own integral coherent bonding field. By this time the cylinder would be visible within the extruder, glimmering from realigned exotic radiation, as if it contained its own galaxy. Instead, Emily and Marcel were sitting on a box-like atomic decay phase junction casing at the base of the cybernetics, drinking tea. Both silent with mournful faces, they flashed him a guilty glance as he came in. "What happened?" he demanded.
"Some kind of instability," Emily said. "I'm sorry, Troblum. The bonding field format wasn't right. Amy had to shut it down."
"And she didn't tell me?"
"Couldn't face you," Marcel said. "She knew how disappointed you'd be. Said she didn't want to be responsible for breaking your heart."
"That's not..."
"Oh," he groaned. Bionix released a flood of neural inhibitors as they detected his thoughts growing more and more agitated. He shivered as if he had been caught by a blast of Arctic air, but his focus was perfectly clear. A list of social priorities flipped up into his exovision. "Thank you for waiting to tell me in person," he said. "I'll call Amy and tell her it wasn't her fault." Emily and Marcel exchanged a blank look.
"That's kind of you," she said.
"How big an instability?"
Marcel winced. Not good. We need to re-examine the whole effect, I think. Can we just strengthen it? I hope so. But even that will be a domino on the internal structure.
Maybe not, Emily said with weak confidence. We included some big operating margins. There's a lot of flexibility within the basic parameters.
Troblum fell silent with a dismay that even the inhibitors could not overcome. If Emily was wrong, if they needed a complete redesign, then the Newman cybernetics would need to be rebuilt. It would take years, again, and this drive generator had been his true hope. He genuinely had thought he would have a functional device by the end of the week. It was the only way to get people to agree with his theory. Marius would see that the Navy never backed a search. He was sure of that. This was all that was left to him, his remaining shred of proof.
You can get the resource allocation, can't you? Marcel said in an encouraging voice. I mean, you've managed to push your theory to this level.
His gesture took in the silent hulk of Newman's cybernetics. You've got to have some powerful political allies on the committees, and this wasn't a setback as such. Only one thing was out of alignment. Troblum deliberately avoided looking in Emily's direction. Marcel had not been one of Marius's candidates.
Yes, I can probably get the EMA for a rebuild.
Okay, then. Do you want to get on it right away or leave it a few days?
Give it a few days, Troblum said, reading from his social priority list. We'll all need a while to recharge after this. I'll start going over the telemetry and give you a call when I think I know what the new bonding field format should be.
Okay. Marcel gave him an encouraging smile as he slid off the casing. There's a certain air technician I've been promising a resort time out with. I'll let her know I'm free. He gave Emily a blank gaze, then left.
Will there be the resources to carry on? She asked.
I don't know. Maybe not from our mutual friend.
At the back of his mind was a nasty little thought that this had been the result that benefited Marius best. Just how far would the Accelerator faction's representative go to achieve that? But I'll carry on one way or another. I still have some personal EMAs left. Her expression grew skeptical as she looked around the huge assemblage of ultra-sophisticated equipment.
All right. If you need any help reviewing the data, let me know.
Thanks, he said. Troblum's office wasn't much. Just a corner in one of the annex rooms big enough for a large wingback chair in the middle of a high-capacity solido projection array. He slumped down into the worn cushioning and stared through the narrow window into the hangar's assembly section. Now that he was alone and the neural chemicals were wearing off, he did not have the heart to begin a diagnostic review. The drive engine should have slid smoothly out of the extruder and into the modified forward cargo hold of Melanie's Redemption. He would have been ready to show the Commonwealth he was right by the end of the week, to open up a whole new chapter in galactic history. Hires were not supposed to become frustrated, but right now he wanted to kick the shit out of the Newman cybernetics. Sometime later that afternoon, the hangar's security net informed Troblum that a capsule had landed on the pad outside. Frowning, he flipped the sensor image out of his peripheral vision and watched as the capsule's door flowed open. Marius stepped out. Troblum actually feared for his life. The warning at the restaurant had been awful enough, but Troblum had been so sure the design for the drive engine was valid, he could not stop thinking that the whole manufacturing process somehow had been knocked deliberately out of kilter, sabotaged, in other words. There was only one person who could have had that done. He gave the Melanie's Redemption a calculating glance. Even with his faction supplied by an Onyx, Marius would not be able to shoot through the ship's force field. It wasn't going to happen. Troblum did not have anywhere to run to. He certainly did not have a friend. Not one. Not anywhere. And if Marius was there to eliminate him, it was on orders from the Accelerators. Hiding inside the starship would only postpone the inevitable. I must start thinking about this, about a way out. Reluctantly, he ordered the hangar net to open the side door. Marius came into the office, gliding along in his usual smoothly imperturbable fashion. He glanced around, not bothering to hide his distaste.
So this is where you spend your days?
Something wrong with that?
Not at all.
Marius gave him a thin smile. Everyone should have a hobby.
Do you?
None you'd appreciate. So what are you here for?
I did as you asked. I haven't pressed the Navy.
I know. And that hasn't gone unnoted. He studied the huge stack of Newman cybernetics through the office window. My commiserations.
You put a lot of effort into today.
How did you know?
The representative's eerie green eyes turned back to stare at Troblum.
Don't be childish. Now, I'm here because you need more funds and we have another little project which might interest you.
A project?
Since he did not seem to be in danger of immediate slaughter, Troblum couldn't help the tweak of interest.
One you'll find difficult to refuse once you know the details. It's an FTL drive, which we're putting into production.
Who knows? Perhaps there will be some overspill into this, which you can take advantage of.
Troblum really could not think what type of drive the ANA faction might want, especially after the last ultra-classified project he had worked on for Marius.
And you'll help me acquire extra EMAs for a rebuild here.
Budgets are tight in these uncertain times, but a swift and successful conclusion to our drive program would probably result in some unused allocation we can divert your way. However, we also have something else you might be interested in.
A bonus, if you like.
What's that?
Bradley Johansson's genome.
What? Impossible. There was nothing left of him.
Not quite. He rejuvenated several times at a clinic on an isolated world. We had an access opportunity several centuries ago.
Are you serious? Marius simply raised an eyebrow.
That sounds good, Troblum said. Really good. I almost don't have to think about it.
I need an answer now. Once again, Troblum was uncertain what would happen if he said no. He could not detect any active embedded weapons in the representative, but that did not mean death wouldn't be sudden and irrevocable.
Talk about carrot and stick.
All right, but first I have to spend a couple of days analyzing what happened here.
We would like you to fly to our assembly station immediately.
If I can't settle this problem to my own satisfaction, I won't be any good to you. I think you know that.
Marius hardened his stare, his eyes darkening from emerald to near black. Very well. You can have 48 hours, no more. I expect you to be on your way by then.
He transferred a flight plan file to Troblum's U-Shadow.
I will be.
It took a lot of bionic intervention to prevent Troblum from shaking as the representative left the office. There was nothing he could do about the sweat staining his suit along his spine.
When the sensors showed him the representative's capsule lifting off the pad, he turned to gaze back into the assembly section. It was all far too neat. The problem on the verge of success, the generous offer to help pay for a solution, plus the unbelievable promise of being able to clone Bradley Johansson. Troblum left his bionic field sweep out to flow through the inert cybernetics.
"What did that bastard do?"
he murmured. Around him the solido projector snapped on, filling the air with a multicolored blizzard of fine equations that sparkled as they interacted. Somewhere, there had to be a flaw in the blueprint that had taken him 15 painstaking years to devise, a deliberate glitch. The only person who could have put it there was Emily. He called up the sections with which she was directly involved. There was an emotion tugging at him as he started to review the data. It took a while, but he eventually realized it was sadness. From the office he was visiting in the hangar, 5 down from Troblum's, the delivery man could just see Marius's capsule as it took to the air again. All he used was his eyes. There was no way the accelerator representative could know he was under direct observation.
"He's gone," he reported, "and that hangar has distorted the spaceport's basic guidance protocols. You can't get there unless you're invited. It's definitely a nest for some bad boy activity. Do you want me to infiltrate?"
"No, thank you," the conservative faction replied. "We'll use passive observation for the moment."
"What about this Troblum character it's registered to?"
"Records indicate he's some kind of Starflyer war enthusiast. His starship flight plan logs are interesting. He visits some out-of-the-way places."
"Do you think he's another representative?"
"No.
He's a physicist with some high-level Navy contacts."
"He's involved with the Navy?"
"Yes."
"In what regard?"
"Leftover artifacts and actions from the Starflyer War.
His interest verges on the fanatical. So why would Marius pay him a personal visit?
Good question. We will research him further.
I can go home now?
Yes.
Excellent. If he got to Arevalo's interstellar wormhole terminus in the next 10 minutes, he could be back home in time for tea with the girls.
Inigo's third dream. It was a glorious summer evening, the bright sun tinting to copper over the Eggshaper Guild compound while Ediard walked across the main nine-sided courtyard. He took a contented breath as he watched the team of 5 G-chimps cleaning the last patch of chymos off the kennel roof. Their strong little claw hands were tearing up long dusty strips of the thick purple vegetation, exposing the pale slate. The kennels were the last of the courtyard buildings to be spruced up. Roofs and gutterings all around the other sides were clean and repaired. There were no more leaks down onto the young genistars, no more drains overflowing every time it rained. The walls also had benefited from the new chimp team renovating the guild compound. The mass of gherkvine had been pruned back to neat fluttering yellow rectangles between doors and windows, allowing the apprentice stonemasons to restore the mortar joins in the walls. An additional benefit of the long-neglected pruning was a bumper crop of fruit this year, with dangling clusters of succulent, claret-coloured berries hanging almost to the ground. Ediard stopped to allow Gonat and Evox to herd the G-horse foals into the stables for the night. "All brushed down and ready?" he asked the 2 young apprentices. He cast his farsight over the animals, checking their short, rough fur for smears of dirt.
"Of course they are," Evox exclaimed indignantly. "I do know how to instruct a G-monkey, Ediard."
Ediard grinned good-naturedly, struck by the way he now sounded like Akim, as he presided over the guild's 3 new apprentices. He could sense Sansia, in a stall, over in the default stables, sitting quietly in a chair as her third hand flowed around an egg, subtly sculpting the nature of the embryonic genistar. The youngsters were talented, impatient naturally, but eager to learn. 2 of the new G-horses had been sculpted by Evox, who was inordinately proud of the foals. Taking on the apprentices had been a real turning point for Akim and Ediard. Evox had joined them barely a week after the fateful Witham caravan the previous year. Sansia and Gonat had moved into the apprentice dormitory before winter set in, and now 2 more farmers were discussing sending children to the guild, at least for the coming winter months. After a hectic 6 months of initiation and adjustment, things had settled down in the compound. Ediard even found that he had some of that most luxurious commodity, spare time. And that was on top of having the compound's G-chimp team start the desperately needed renovation. With the apprentices honing their instructional skills, the chimps had performed some internal restoration, whitewashing walls, cleaning floors, and even preserving food in jars and casks. This coming winter season would not be as bleak as those in the past.
"How are the cats?" Gonat asked.
"Just going to inspect them," Ediard said. So successful had the G-cats been at extracting water, the council had commissioned a second well to be dug at the other end of the cliff face behind the village. As well as producing replacements for the existing well, Ediard now had to supervise a whole new nest. In truth, they did not last as long as he had hoped, barely 2 years, and they were still inordinately difficult to sculpt.
"Don't forget we have a delivery from Doddett Farm in the morning. Make sure there's enough room in the stores."
"Yes," Gonat and Evox groaned. They mentally pushed and goaded the frisky foals into their stable before Ediard could heap any more tasks on them. The whole courtyard resonated to the hoots, snarls, bleating, and barks of various genera. With the apprentices now capable of basic sculpting, the guild had suddenly doubled its hatching rates. There were a full 20 defaults in the stables. Akim had consulted with Wedard on building more. The majority of the animals still went out to the farms, but most houses in the village had cleaned out their disused nests and asked for a G-chimp or a monkey. The demand for G-wolves, since the Witham caravan, had increased dramatically. It was what Ediard had wanted, but he was still disheartened by the way the older villagers refused to let him give them a simple refresher course in instruction, gruffly informing him that they had been ordering genistars around since before his parents were born. True enough, but if one had been doing it wrong since then,
Nothing was going to change, and they would wind up with a lot of badly behaved Genistars cavorting around Ashwell, annoying everyone. Ediard surreptitiously tried to make sure that the village children had a decent grounding in the ability. The lady's mother, Lorelin, helped in her own quiet way by allowing Ediard to sit in on her instructions to the village youth. Nobody dared to protest that. Ediard reached the main hall and sped up the stairs, pleased to be away from the courtyard. A further side effect of their guild's rising fortune and greater Genistar numbers was the stronger smell seeping out from the stables. He had moved out of the apprentice dormitory the week Evox had arrived, taking over a journeyman's room. "I can't confirm you as a master yet," Akeem had said gravely. "No matter what you did beyond these walls, or how proficient you are, guild procedures must be followed. To be a master, you must have served at least 5 years as a journeyman."
"I understand," Ediard had replied, secretly laughing at the formality.
"Lady, help us from the way old people try to keep the world in order." "And I'll thank you to take the guild a little more seriously, please," Akeem had snapped. Ediard had wound down his amusement rapidly. Akeem seemed able to sense any emotion, however well hidden. His new room actually had some furniture in it, a decent desk he had commissioned from the Carpentry Guild, and a cupboard and chest of drawers he needed to store his growing new wardrobe. His cot had a soft mattress of goose down. After some gruesome disasters, he eventually had got the finer points of the laundry ritual over to his personal G-monkey, so once a week he had fresh sheets, scented with lavender, from the herb bed in the compound's small kitchen garden, also now properly maintained. He washed quickly, using the big china jug of water. The guild compound wasn't yet connected to the village's rudimentary water pipe network, but Melzar had promised that would be done by the end of the month. Both he and the smithy were trying to design a domestic stove that would heat water for individual cottages, producing various ungainly contraptions with pipes coiled around them. So far the pipes had all burst or leaked, but they were making progress. Ediard scraped Akeem's ancient spare razor over his straggly chin hairs, wincing at the little cuts the jagged blade made. A new razor was next on his list of commissions, and a decent mirror. The G-chimps had left a pile of newly washed clothes, from which he chose a loose white cotton shirt, wearing it with his smart dross-silk trousers. He had found several weaver women in the village who would make clothes for him in return for G-spiders. Akeem called the unregistered trade enterprising, cautioning that it must not interfere with their official commissions. He still had the boots he had bought in Witham, a little worn after a year, but they remained comfortable and intact. The only problem was how tight they were becoming. He had put on nearly 2 inches of height in the last year, not that he had bulked out at all. His horror was that he would wind up looking like Fahin, as he put on more height without the corresponding girth. He opened the top of the small stone barrel in the corner opposite the fire, and removed the leather shoulder bag. It was one place relatively immune from casual farsight. He checked that the bag's contents had not been discovered by the other apprentices and slung the strap over his arm. "Very dapper," Akeem observed. Ediard jumped, clutching the bag in an obviously guilty fashion. He had not noticed the old master sitting in the main hall. Everyone had been trying to duplicate the way the bandits had shielded themselves, with varying degrees of success. Ediard was not sure how much mental effort Akeem put into the effect. He'd always had the ability to sit quietly and blend naturally into the background. "Thank you," Ediard replied. He self-consciously tugged at the bottom of his shirt. "Off out, are you?" Akeem asked with sly amusement. He gestured at the long table set for five. He had made nothing of the bag.
Yes. My tasks are complete. I'll start sculpting the new horses and dogs for Gibbet's farm tomorrow. 3 of the defaults are ovulating. The males are in their pens."
"Some things are definitely easier for other species," Akeem observed, and gave Ediard's clothes another meaningful look. "So which of our town's fine establishments are you gracing tonight?"
I can't afford the tavern. It's just me and some of the other apprentices getting together, that's all."
"How lovely. Are any of your fellow apprentices female, by any chance?"
Edyard clamped down hard on his thoughts, but there was nothing he could do about his burning cheeks.
I guess Ziha will be there, possibly Kalindi.
He shrugged his innocence in such matters. For once Akeem appeared awkward, though he had put a strong shield around his own thoughts.
Lad, perhaps sometime we should talk about such things.
Things?
Edyard muttered in alarm.
Girls, Edyard, after all, you are 16 now. I'm sure you notice them these days.
You do know what to ask Doc Senyo for if circumstances become favourable.
Edyard's expression was frozen into place as he prayed to the lady for this horror to end.
Yes, I do. Thank you.
Go to Doc Senyo and ask for a phial of Vinac juice. Oh, dear lady, I'd rather chop it off altogether.
Akeem sat back in his chair and let his gaze rise to the ceiling.
Ah, I remember my own youthful amorous adventures back in Macathran. Oh, those city girls in all their finery.
The ones of good family would do nothing else all day but pamper and groom themselves for the parties and balls that were thrown at night.
Edyard, I so wish you could see them.
There isn't one you wouldn't fall in love with at first sight. Of course, they all had the devil in them when you got their bodices off. But what a vision they were.
I have to go or I'll be late, Edyard blurted.
Someone of Akeem's age should not be allowed to use words like amorous and bodice.
Of course, the old master seemed amused by something.
I have been selfish, keeping you here.
I'm not that late.
And I don't mean tonight.
I'm not up to instructing you anymore, Edyard.
You have almost outgrown your master. I think you should go to Macathran to study at the guild in their blue tower. My name may still be remembered. At the very least, my title demands some prerogatives. I can write you a letter of sponsorship.
No. I can't possibly go.
Why not? Akeem asked mildly.
To Macathran? Me? No. Anyway, it's so far away, I don't even know how far. How would I get there?
Same way everyone does, my boy. You travel in one of the caravans. This is not impossible or remote, Edyard. You must learn to lift your eyes above the horizon, especially in this province. I would not see you stifled by Ashwell. For that is what surely will happen if you remain. I do not want your talent wasted. There is more to this world, this life, than a single village alone on the edges of the wilderness. Why, just travelling to Macathran will show you that.
I will hardly waste my talent by staying here. The village needs me. Look what has happened already with more Genistars.
Ah, really? The village is already nervous about you, Edyard. You are strong, you are smart, they are neither. Oh, don't get me wrong. This is a pleasant place for someone like me to live out my remaining days. But it is not for you. Ashwell has endured for centuries before you. It will endure for centuries yet. Trust me, a place and people this stubborn and rooted in what they are will not vanish into the black heart of Honius without you. I will write your letter this week. The Barkus caravan is due before the end of the month. I know Barkus of old. He owes me some favours. You can leave with them.
This month? He whispered in astonishment. So soon?
Yes. There is no benefit in delay. My mind is clear on this matter.
The new G-cats?
I can manage, Edyard. Please, don't make this any more difficult for me.
Edyard walked over to the old master.
Thank you, sir. This is, he grinned, beyond imagination.
Ha! We'll see how much you thank me in a year's time. The masters of the Blue Tower are not nearly as lax as I have grown. They will have a fine time beating obedience into you. Your bones will be black and blue before the first day is half gone.
I will endure, Edyard said. He laid a hand on the man's shoulder, for once allowing the love he felt to shine in his mind. I will prove you right to them. Whatever happens, I will endure it for you. I will never give them cause to doubt your pupil, and I will make you proud.
Akeem gripped the hand, squeezing strongly. I am already proud.
Now come, you are dallying while your friends carouse. Leave now and I will have yet another fine meal with our three juvenile dunderwits, listening to their profound talk and answering their challenging questions.
Edyard laughed. I am a bad apprentice, deserting my master thus.
Indeed you are. Now go, for the lady's sake. Let me summon up what is left of my courage, else I shall flee to the tavern.
Edyard turned and walked out of the hall. He almost stopped, wanting to ask what Hakim had meant by, they are already nervous about you. He would inquire tomorrow.
Edyard, Hakim called.
Yes, master.
A word of caution. Stay silent that you are leaving, even to your friends. Envy is not a pretty blossom, and it has a custom of breeding resentment.
Yes, master.
The sun had dropped to the top of the rampart wall by the time Eddie had hurried up a lane off the main street, heading for the granite cliff at the back of the village. Already the glowing colours of the night sky were emerging through the day's blue, like trees out of morning mist. Old Buluku was directly overhead, the vulpine serpent manifesting as a violet stream that slithered through the heavens in a fashion that none of Corentia's few astronomers could ever fathom. It certainly did not shift with the seasons, or even orbit around the sun. As Edyard watched, a sliver of electric blue light rippled lazily along its length, a journey that would take several minutes, too weak to cast a shadow across the dry mud of the lane. Odin Sea already was drifting toward the northern horizon, a roughly oval patch of glowing blue and green mist that visited the summer nights. The lady's teachings were that it formed the heart of the void, where the souls of men and women were carried by the Sky Lords, so that they could dream away the rest of existence in quiet bliss. It was only the good and the worthy who were blessed with such a voyage, and the Sky Lords had not been seen in Quarentia's skies for so long. They were nothing but legend and a faith kept by the lady's followers. Protruding from the ragged edges of Odin's Sea were the reefs, scarlet promontories on which Sky Lords, carrying the souls of those less worthy, were wrecked, and began their long fall into Honius and Oblivion. Edyard often wondered if so many unworthy humans had been carried aloft by Sky Lords that there were simply no more of the great creatures left. It would be so typical that humans should bring such a casual destruction to this universe. Thankfully, the lady's teachings said that it was humans who had declined in spirit. That was why the Empyrean Lady had been anointed by the First Lives, to guide humans back to the path that once again would lead them to the heart of the void. It was a sad fact that not many people listened to the lady's kind words these days. "Calling to the Sky Lords?" a voice asked. Edyard smiled and turned. His farsight had kept watch on her since she had stepped out of the church 10 minutes earlier, one of the reasons he had chosen this particular route. Saldrana emerged from the shadows of the marketplace. Behind the deserted stalls, the church curved up above the rest of the village buildings with quiet purpose. Its crystal roof glimmered in refraction from the altar lanterns.
They didn't answer, he said. They never do. One day they will. Besides, you're not quite ready to sail into the heart yet.
No, I'm not. Edyard could not quite match her humour. He might as well have been travelling into the heart, given the distance to Macathran. How will she cope with me leaving? He was not the only one growing up that summer. Saldrana also had put on several inches over the last couple of years. Her shoulders were broad, as if she was growing into a typical sturdy farmer's girl. But whereas her contemporaries were thickening out, ready for their century of toil on the land, she remained slim and agile. Her plain blue and white novice robe had grown quite tight, which always made Edyard glance at her in an inappropriate fashion. Not that there was any helping it. She was losing her puppy fat to reveal the sharpest cheekbones he'd ever seen. Everyone could see how beautiful she was going to be. Thankfully, she still suffered from pimples, and her auburn hair remained wild and girlish. Otherwise, being in her presence would be intolerable. As it was, he viewed her friendship with delight and dismay in equal measure. She was far too young to be wanting to bed, though he could not help wondering how long it would be before she was old enough. Such thoughts made him fearful that the lady would strike him down with a giant lightning bolt roaring out from Honius itself, though, of course, her priestesses did marry. Irrelevant now. Even if I do come back, it won't be for years. She'll be with some village oaf and have 3 children.
You're in a funny mood, Saldrana said, all innocent and curious. Is everything all right?
Yeah, actually it is. I've had some good news. Great news.
He held up a hand, and I will tell you later. I promise.
Gosh, a secret. And in Ashwell. Bet I find out by noon tomorrow.
Bet you don't.
Bet me what? No, I'm being unfair.
It's a private thing.
Now you're just being cruel. I'll pray to the lady for your redemption.
That's very kind. She stood close to him, still smiling sweetly.
So, are you off up to the caves?
Yeah. One or two of the others said they might go in.
I thought I'd see. So when do I get asked?
I don't think Mother Laurelin would want you in the caves at night.
Pha! There's a lot of things the good mother doesn't know I do.
She shook her hair defiantly, squaring her shoulders. The aggressive pose lasted a couple of seconds before she started giggling.
Well, I'll pray she doesn't find out, he told her. Thank you, Edyard.
Her hand rubbed playfully along his arm.
Who'd have thought it just a few years ago? Both of us happy. And you one of the lads now.
I was in a fight before they accepted me. I killed people. Even now he could still see the face of the bandit before the man smashed into the tree. The astonishment and fear.
Of course you were. That's a typical boy thing. That's why you're going into the caves again tonight. We all have to find a way to live here, Edyard. We're going to be in Ashwell for a long, long time.
He could not answer, just gave her a fixed smile.
And watch out for that Zihar. She's already bragging how she intends to have you.
She was very descriptive for a baker's apprentice.
She is? She wants...
Sarana's face was devilsome.
Oh, yes.
She blew him a kiss, giggling. Let me know the details. I'm dying to know if you can really do such wicked things. Then her back was to him, her skirt held high by both hands, and she went racing down the slope, giggling all the way. Edyard let out a long breath. His emotions were as unsteady as his legs. If there was ever a reason to stay in Ashwell, he was looking at it. His farsight followed her long after she had turned a corner onto the main street, making sure she was safe as she ran along on her errand. There were a number of caves burrowing into the cliffs behind Ashwell. A lot of them had been expanded over the decades, modified into storerooms for the long winter months, where the temperature and moisture hardly varied. Several of the larger ones were used as barns. Edyard was not interested in those. Instead, he headed for a small, oddly angled fissure in the rock on the western end of the cliff, only 30 yards from where the encircling wall began. He had to scramble up a pile of smoothed boulders to reach it, then grip the upper lip and swing himself into the darkness. Anyone larger than he would have real trouble passing through the gap. He'd be able to use it for only another year or so. Once he was inside, the passage opened up and the soft background babble of the village's long talk cut off abruptly. His immediate world contracted to a dank, gloomy blackness. Even his farsight ability could not perceive through such a depth of rock. All he could sense was the open cavity around him. Only after he had gone around a curve did he see a glint of yellow light ahead. 7 apprentices were gathered in the narrow cave with its high crevice apex, sitting around a couple of battered old lamps whose wicks were chuffing out a lot of smoke. Their talk stopped as he entered, then their smiles bloomed in welcome. It was a gratifying sensation of belonging. Even Oberon raised a cheery hand. Fahin beckoned him over. Edyard was very conscious of Zihar watching him with a nearly feline intent and gave her a nervous grin. Her answering smile was carnivorous.
Didn't think you were coming, Fahin said. I got delayed slightly, Edyard explained.
He opened his bag and pulled out the large wine bottle, which earned him some appreciative whistles as he held it up. Fahin leaned in closer.
Thought you were running scared of Zihar,
he murmured in a knowing whisper.
Sweet lady, has she told everyone but me? I overheard it from Marilee. She was trying to get Kalina to take some Vinac juice from Senio's pharmacology store. I assumed you were party to it.
No, Edyard growled.
Okay, well, should the need arise, and I do mean rise, just ask me. I can get you a file without anyone being any the wiser, especially Senio.
I shall remember it well, thank you. Fahin nodded as if unconcerned,
the attitude confirmed by his passive surface thoughts. He unbuckled his ancient physics satchel and took out some dried kestrel leaves. The pair of them became the center of some not very subtle attention from the other apprentices in the cave. Ediard shifted position and opened the wine. It was dark red, which Akeem always claimed was a sign of quality. Ediard was never certain. All the wine available in Ashwell had a strong taste that lingered well into the next day. He supposed he would get used to it eventually, but as for actually liking it... Fahin, where do you see yourself in 50 years? The tall doctor's apprentice glanced up from the little slate pestle he was preparing.
You're very serious tonight, my friend. Mind you, she does have that effect on people.
For an instant, Ediard thought he was talking about Salrana. Then Fahin's eyes glanced over at Ziha, a movement amplified by his oversized lenses.
No, Ediard said irritably. Seriously, come on. 50 years' time. What are you working toward?
Why, I'll be the doctor, of course. Senio is actually a lot older than most people realize. And she says I am her most promising apprentice in decades.
He began grinding the kestrel leaves with smooth, easy motions of the mortar.
That's it.
Village doctor.
Yes.
Fahin was not looking at Ediard anymore. His thoughts took on an edge.
I'm not like you, Ediard. Honius, take me. I'm not even like Oberon. I'm sure you're going to build our Eggshaper Guild to greatness over the next century. You'll probably be mayor inside 30 years. Ashwell's name will spread. People will come, and this land will flourish once again. We all hope that from you. So, given the circumstances, village doctor and your friend in such times is no small goal after all.
You truly think I will do that?
You can do it.
Fahin mashed the last flakes of leaf into a thin powder.
Either that or you'll lead a barbarian army to sack Macathran and overthrow the old order. You have the strength to do either.
I saw it. We all did. That sort of strength attracts people. Don't say that, Ediard said. Not even in jest.
Who's jesting?
Fahin poured the kestrel powder into a small white clay pipe, adding some tobacco. Ediard stared at his friend in some alarm. Is this what people think? Is this why I make them nervous?
You know, the gate guards say they still far-sight your fast foxes at night sometimes, Fahin said. Do you keep them out there?
What?
No. I sent it away when we got back. You were with me. You saw me do it.
And how would the guards know that, the old fools? They're asleep most of the night anyway, and they can't tell one animal from another at any distance.
These fast foxes have collars. They're not mine, he insisted.
Wait. There's more than one.
You know I only mastered one.
When did they see them? Fahin struck a match and sucked hard on his pipe stem, pulling the flame down into the bowl.
I'm not sure, he said, as he puffed out some smoke. A couple of months now.
Why did nobody tell me? I could find out if they are real.
Why, indeed?
The match went out, and Fahin took a deep drag. Almost immediately, his eyes lost focus. Ediard stared at his friend with growing dismay. They all gathered here for a drink and a smoke and talk, just as apprentices had done since Ashwell was founded. But lately Fahin was smoking on a nearly nightly basis. It was a habit that had grown steadily ever since they got back from the Witham caravan.
Sweet lady,
Ediard muttered as the other apprentices came over. Maybe leaving this place is the right thing to do. Fahin passed the pipe to Genril. A smiling Ziha held out a hand for Ediard's wine. He deliberately took a huge swig before handing it over. The first thing Ediard did when he woke up was retch horribly. When he tried to turn over, he banged his temple hard on cold floorboards. It took a moment to realize it, but he was not lying on his nice soft mattress. For some reason, he was sprawled on the floor beside the cot, still fully dressed apart from one boot, and he stank. He groaned again and felt the acid rising in his throat, gave up all attempts at control, and threw up spectacularly. As he did so, the fear hit, squeezing cold sweat from every pore. He was shaking as he wiped pitifully at the fluid dribbling from his lips, nearly weeping with misery. Hangovers he could take, even those from red wine, but this was more than just the payback for overindulgence.
He had felt like this before. The forest. The bandit ambush. His body was reacting to the alcohol and a couple of puffs on the pipe, but his mind was yelling at some deep, instinctive level of the mortal danger closing in from the surrounding darkness. He forced himself to sit up. A thin pastel light from the night sky washed around the shutters, revealing his small room. Nothing was amiss, apart from himself. He whimpered from the sheer intensity of fright pouring through him, expecting something terrible to envelop him at any second. The hangover made his head throb painfully. It was hard to concentrate, but he slowly managed to summon up some farsight and scan around himself. The three apprentices were asleep in their dormitory. He forced the ability further, almost crying out from the pain sparking behind his eyes. Akeem, too, was asleep on his bed. Out in the courtyard, the young Genistars dozed the night away, shuffling and shaking as was their style. A couple of cats trod delicately along the roofs as they tracked small rodents. By the gate, the G-Wolf, in its traditional stone guard kennel, lay curled up on its legs, big head swaying slowly as it obediently kept watch on the road outside. Edyard groaned with the effort of searching so far, and let his farsight wither to nothing. He was still shaking and cold. The front of his shirt was disgustingly sticky, and the smell was getting worse. Nausea threatened to return. He struggled out of the shirt and lurched over to the nightstand, where there was a glass of water, and took several large gulps. In the drawer at the bottom of the little stand was a pouch of dried June petals soaked in an oil that Fahin had prepared. He opened it, closed his eyes, and shoved one of the petals into his mouth. It tasted foul, but he took a final gulp from the glass, forcing it down. In all his 16 years he had never felt so wretched, and still the fear would not abate. Tears threatened to clog his eyes as he shivered again, hugging his chest. "What is wrong with me?" He wobbled over to the window and pushed the shutters open. Cool night air flowed in. Odin Sea had fallen nearly below the horizon. That meant it was no more than a couple of hours past midnight. The low-thatched roofs of the village were spread out around him, pale in the wan, flickering light of the nebulae. Nothing moved, but for whatever reason, the sight of such serenity made the fear even worse. For an instant he heard screams, saw flames. His stomach churned, and he bent over the windowsill. "Lady, why do you do this to me?" When he straightened up, he instinctively looked at the village gate with its twin watchtowers. There was no sign of the guards, but they were nearly half a mile away and it was night. Edyard gathered his breath and gripped the side of the windows in grim determination. His farsight surged out. "If they're all right, I'm going straight back to bed." The towers were built from smooth-faced stone. Recent decades had seen them strengthened inside with thick timber bracing. Even so, there were no holes in the walls, just some alarmingly long cracks zigzagging up and down. Their parapets were large enough to hold 10 guards, who could fire a number of heavy weapons down on anyone foolish enough to storm the gate. This night the eastern tower was empty. A solitary man stood on the western parapet underneath the alarm bell. He was facing inward, looking across the village. 3 bodies lay on the flagstones at his feet. Edyard lurched in shock and tried to refocus his farsight. It swept in and out before centering back on the parapet. The lone man's thoughts shone with a hue of satisfaction. Edyard felt a filthy mental smile. "Greetings," the man long talked. Edyard's throat contracted, snagging his breath. "Who are you?" Mental laughter mocked him. "We know who you are. We know all about you, tough boy. We know what you did to our friends. Because of that, you're mine tonight, and I promise you won't die quickly." Edyard yelped in horror and dived away from the window. Even so, he could still feel the tenuous touch of the other's farsight upon him. He put as much strength as he could behind his long talk and cried, "Akeem! Akeem, wake up! The bandits are here! They're in the village!" His mental shout was like some kind of signal. The soft glow of mines materialized in the alleyways and lanes that wound through the cottages and guild compounds. Edyard screamed. They were everywhere. "So many. Every bandit in the wilderness must be here tonight." "What in the lady's name?" Akeem's fuzzy thoughts came questioning. "Bandits,"
Edyard called again, with voice and mind. Hundreds of them. They're already here. He jabbed every G-Wolf in the compound with a mental goad, triggering their attack state. Loud, dangerous snarling rose from the courtyard. Five bandits appeared in the street outside the guild, strong and confident, making no further attempt at cover. They did not have the muddy skin and wild hair of the ones in the forest. These bandits wore simple dark tunics and sturdy boots. There were no bows and arrows either. Strangely, they wore two belts apiece, looped around the shoulders, so that they crossed over the chest. Little metal boxes were clipped onto the leather, along with a variety of knives. Whispers spilled out of the ether as they long-talked. Then Edyard sensed the fast foxes walking beside them. Each had two of the tamed and trained beasts. "Oh, sweet lady, no," he gasped. His mind registered Akim long-talking the other elders, fast and precise thoughts raising the alarm. It was too late. Flames appeared among Ashwell's rooftops. Torches thick with oil fire spun through the air, guided by telekinesis to land full square on thatch roofs. The fire spread quickly, encouraged by the dry months of a good summer. A dreadful orange glow began to cover the village. The G-Wolves were racing across the guild courtyard. Edyard extended his third hand with furious intent and slammed the gates open for them. That was when he heard the noise for the first time. An awful, thunderous roar, as if 100 pistols were all firing at once. White light flashed across his open window, and his mind felt the dirty glee of the bandits' thoughts coming from the street below. G-Wolves fell in torment, their minds radiating terrible flares of pain as their flesh was shredded. Some of them managed to survive the strange weapons only to collide with fast foxes. The metallic roaring abated as the animals fought, tearing at each other as they writhed and spun and jumped. That was when Edyard heard a woman scream. There was too much turmoil, too much anguish storming across Ashwell for his farsight to track her down, but he knew what the sound meant, what it would mean for every woman in the village caught alive, and every girl. He sent a single, piercing thought at the church. "Salrana!" "Edyard," her panicked long talk barked back. "They're here. They're in the church." His mind found her instantly, farsight zooming in as if he were illuminating her with a powerful beam of light. She was cowering in her room in the mother's house that formed the back of the church. Inside the dome itself, three bandits were advancing along the empty aisles, radiating triumph and contempt as their fast foxes stalked beside them. Mother Lorelin was already out of bed and heading for the church to deal with the desecrators. For a devout woman, her mind shone with inordinately strong aggression. The bandits and their fast foxes would cut her to ribbons, Edyard knew. "Get out," he told Salrana. "Move now, out of the window and into the garden. Stay ahead of them. Keep moving. Head for the market. It's cobbled. There's no fire there. I'll meet you at the corn measure station."
"Oh, Edyard."
"Do it. Do it now." He raced over to the window. It was not such a big jump to the street, and the carnage the fast foxes were wreaking on the surviving G-Wolves was almost over. Whatever victors were left, he could take care of them. Flames were racing across the thatch of the terraced cottages opposite. Doors were flung open, and men charged out, shields firm around their bodies, knives held high. The bandits raised their weapons, and the noise began again. Edyard watched numbly as the squat guns spit a blue-purple flame. Somehow they were firing dozens of bullets, reloading impossibly fast. The villagers shook and flailed in agony as the bullets overwhelmed their shields.
"Bastards!"
Edyard yelled and jumped.
"No, don't!"
Akim's long talk was strong enough to make half the village pause. Even the guns were temporarily still. Edyard landed, his bare heel shooting pain up his leg. He turned toward the nearest bandit, crouching as if he were about to go for a wrestling hold. Somehow he sensed Akim and the bandit in the guard tower both holding their breath. The bandit in front of him lifted the dark gun, snarling with delight. Edyard reached out with his third hand, closing it around the gun. He was not sure if his shield could withstand so many bullets striking at him, but as with every gun, one first had to pull the trigger. The bandit's eyes widened in surprise, as his own shielding was unable to ward off Edyard's power. Then the street was subject to an unnerved screech as the bandit's fingers were snapped in quick succession.
Edyard rotated the gun in front of the bandit's numb gaze until the man was staring right into the muzzle, then pulled hard on the trigger. The discharge was awesome, even though it lasted barely a second before something snarled inside the gun's mechanism. It blew the bandit's head apart. Tatters of gore lashed down on the muddy street. Three other bandits raised their guns. Edyard exerted himself, gripping their flesh tight with his third hand, preventing the slightest movement. "Get them," he told the surviving villagers, stumbling out of the blazing cottages.
"Oh, your death will be exquisite,"
the bandit in the watchtower sent. A gun roared behind Edyard. He turned, flinching, to see the fifth bandit falling on his own weapon, borne down by a swarm of G-chimps that Akim had instructed.
"I did say don't,"
Akim's long talk chided.
"Thank you,"
Edyard replied. The villagers were dispatching the bandits with a ferocity that he found disturbing. Edyard let go of the bloody corpses. Then everyone was turning to him, awaiting guidance.
"Get into the guild compound,"
he told them, aware of how it became an eerie echo of Malzar's instructions back in the forest.
"Group together. That will give your shields real strength."
"You too, lad,"
Akim said as Edyard picked up one of the bandit's guns. It was a lot heavier than he was expecting. A sweep with his farsight revealed an internal mechanism that was inordinately complicated. He did not understand anything about it other than the trigger. There did not seem to be many bullets left in the metal box in front of the stock.
"I have to help Selrana."
"No. All's lost there. Get out. Live, Edyard, please. Just survive tonight. Don't let them win."
Edyard started running up the street, wincing every time his bootless foot touched the ground.
"They won't destroy this village." "They already have, lad. Take cover. Get out."
He sent his farsight flowing out ahead, alert for any bandits, and saw Fast Fox loping along an alley. When it emerged, Edyard was almost level with it. He pushed his third hand into the creature's skull and ripped its brain apart. It fell in the evil wavering light of burning thatch. The street was a gully of leaping flame, as bright as any dawn. Screams, shouts, and gunfire split the harsh, constant flame growl.
"You are good, aren't you?"
the watchtower bandit taunted. Edyard pushed his farsight into the tower, but the man was no longer there. A quick scan of the surrounding area revealed nothing except the broken main gates and dead village guards.
"Where did he go?"
Edyard asked fretfully. "Akim, help! I can't sense half of them." He actually heard a gun mechanism snick smoothly and hardened his shield. The blast of bullets came from a cottage he'd just passed. He was lucky, he decided afterward. Not all of the bullets hit him. The bandit's aim was off. That and his mind picked up a quiet long talk.
"No, not him."
Even so, the force of the shots that did hit was enough to send him sprawling backward, half dazed. He instinctively lashed out with his third hand to the source of the shots. A bandit went staggering across the road, shaking his head. Edyard reached up to the furnace of thatch above and tugged hard. Dense waves of flame peeled off the disintegrating roof and splashed down over the bandit, driving him to his knees. His screams, thankfully, were muffled.
"Are you all right?" Akim asked.
Edyard groaned as he rolled back to his feet. There were flames everywhere, their ferocity sending huge sparking balls of thatch high into the sky. Windows and doors were belching out twisting orange streamers. The heat was intense on his bare torso. He was sure he could feel his skin starting to crack and blister.
"I'm here," he replied, "but I can't sense them. I don't know where they are."
And he knew the watchtower bandit was coming, slipping stealthily through the swirling flames and sagging walls.
"Try this,"
Akim said. His long talk voice became stretched as if rising to birdsong. It seemed to fill Edyard's skull. It was a knowledge gift, thoughts and sometimes memories that explained how to perform a specific mental task. Edyard had absorbed hundreds of basic explanations on the art of sculpting, but this was far more complex. As the song ended, he began to shape his farsight and third hand together into a symbiotic force that wove darkness through the air around him. It was like standing in the middle of a thick patch of fog.
"Now, please,"
Akim pleaded, "get out.
Do not waste your life, Edyard. Don't make some futile gesture, please. Remember the Blue Tower in Makathran. Go there. Be
someone.
I can't leave you, he cried into the terrible night.
The village is already lost. Now go.
Go,
Edyard. Don't let everything be wasted.
Edyard wanted to shout out that his master was wrong, that his valiant apprentice friends and strong masters such as Malzar and Weddard were leading the fight. But looking at the fiery devastation around him, he knew it was not true. The screams still were filling the air, along with the snarl of fast foxes and the deadly clamour of guns. Resistance was contracting to a few guild compounds and halls. The rest of the village was burning to ruin. There was nothing to be saved, except Salrana. Edyard forced himself to his feet and started running toward the market again. Once a bandit hurried past him along the street, not 5 yards away. The man never knew how close they were. Edyard could have killed him easily, extracted some vengeance. But that would have shown the watchtower bandit where he was, and even through his anger and desperation, Edyard knew he had neither the skill nor the strength to win that confrontation. He sped past 3 more bandits before charging into the marketplace. The square was surrounded by a wall of flame, but it was cooler amid the stalls. 2 bandits were holding down a woman, laughing while the 3rd of their band raped her. Their fast foxes prowled around the little group, keeping guard. Edyard just could not ignore it. He even recognized the woman, though he did not know her name. She worked at the tannery, helping prepare the hides. The first the bandits knew of anything amiss was when their fast foxes suddenly stopped circling. All 6 beasts swung their heads around, huge jaws opening to ready fangs the size of human fingers. "What?" one of the bandits managed to say. He brought his gun up, but it was too late. The fast foxes leaped. More screams echoed out around the stalls.
"Ah, there you are," a long, taut voice gloated. "I was worried you'd run away from me."
Edyard snarled into the smoke-wreathed sky. Try as he might, he could not track where the long talk was originating.
"Now, what are you doing there? Apart from slaughtering my comrades? Oh, yes, I see."
Edyard was aware of Salrana hunched up behind the counter in the corn measure stall, glancing upward with a puzzled expression. He started to sprint toward her.
"He's in the marketplace," the bandit announced across the whole village. "Close in."
Edyard sensed bandits turning to head toward him.
"Oh, she is lovely.
The very young one from the church, isn't it?"
"Yes, I recognize her. Well, congratulations, my tough little friend. Good choice. She's certainly worth risking everything for."
Edyard reached the corn measure stall and dropped his concealment. Salrana gasped in astonishment as he appeared in front of her.
"Got you."
Edyard was only too well aware of the urgent satisfaction in the bandit's long talk. There was the tiniest flashover of pounding feet, leg muscles straining with effort to get there, to capture the feared boy.
"Right at the end, I'm going to cut your eyelids off, so you have no choice but to watch while I fuck her," the bandit said,
twinning his long talk with a burst of dark pleasure.
"It'll be the last thing you see before you die.
But you'll go straight to Honius, knowing this.
I'll keep her for my own. She's coming with me, tough boy, and I'll put her to work every single night. Your girl is going to spend the next decade bearing my children."
"Get up!"
Edyard yelled, and tugged at Salrana's arm. She was crying, her limbs limp and unresponsive.
"Don't let them get me," she wept. "Please, Edyard. Kill me. I couldn't stand that. I couldn't. I'd rather spend eternity in Honius."
"Never," he said. His arms went around her, and he enfolded her within his concealment.
"Get the fast foxes in the market," the bandit ordered. "Track him. Find his scent."
"Come on,"
Edyard whispered. He started for the main entrance, then stopped. Over 10 bandits with their fast foxes were heading up the street toward him. They ignored the frantic chickens and gibbering G-chimps that were running away from the swirl of lethal flames consuming the buildings.
"Lady!"
He searched, not daring to use his farsight in case the diabolical bandit could detect that.
"I don't care if the fire's making it hard to track. Find him."
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.